Thanks very much for your time. To begin with, could you say a little bit about your aims for the new book and the various theoretical debates you intervene in?
Okay, Mark. Well, thank you for talking to me. The book is really concerned with the traditional problem of social structure that we've had in the social sciences since almost the time that they began. Georg Simmel called it an old problem 100 years ago, and I don't think there's really been a satisfactory resolution. So I'm looking at questions like, does social structure exist? And if it does exist, in what form does it exist? And how is it possible that it could have the kind of causal significance that people commonly attribute to it? And there's an element also of that, the question of structure and agency. To what extent is structure, how does structure relate to individual actors and the contributions that they make? So those are the questions that I'm looking at in this book.
And you draw heavily on the critical realist tradition, but the book's also a distinct contribution to that tradition. Could you say a little bit about where you stand in relation to it?
Well, I draw quite substantially in the book on some of the early work of Roy Bhaskar, particularly the work that he did in a book called A Realist Theory of Science on the nature of causality. And at the same time also drawing on work that's been done already by a critical realist sociologist, most strikingly Margaret Archer, who's also tried to apply the concept of emergence, which is central to my approach, to issues of social structure. So there is a sense, I think, in critical realism that there are kind of different phases of Bhaskar's thought, and critical realists can almost be classified by which phases of his thinking they find most useful. I'm a kind of phase one critical realist in that sense. I'm drawing on the early work on causality and some of his early work on the social.
And less so the dialectical and spiritual work.
Indeed. I haven't found any need to use those in my work.
And the concept of emergence is crucial for many of the arguments in your book. And yet,
indeed,
you're offering a distinct concept of emergence in relation to many of the others in philosophy of social science.
Yes. The concept of emergence, as I understand it, is to do with emergent properties that things or entities can have. So when a thing or an entity, as I like to call them, has an emergent property, what I mean by that is that it has properties that its parts wouldn't have if they weren't organized into that kind of entity. And to use a very non-sociological example, consider the example of a torch. So a torch is a fairly simple physical object. It's got some sort of casing, a battery, some wires, a switch, and a bulb, perhaps some other bits. And those pieces between them, you wouldn't be able to shine a light unless they were put together into the form of a torch. So the power to shine a light isn't a property of the bulb or the battery or the casing or even all of those things together, unless they're organized into a torch. And that, for me, makes it an emergent property of the torch. And so that's a quite a simple concept of emergence. And it's distinct from a whole variety of concepts of emergence, which are sometimes called strong concepts of emergence, in which emergence is something a little mysterious. In those sorts of theories of emergence, the possession of a property by a thing is somehow as a result of something extra beyond the parts and the relations between them that make up that thing. Whereas in the view of emergence that I'm adopting, it's always an emergent property is always something that is potentially explainable.
And that's one of the aspects of your discussion that I found most insightful, because you bring a lot of clarity to this relationship that, as you say, is often a bit mysterious. Mm-hmm. And does this account of the relationship between parts and wholes apply equally for the objects of natural science and social science?
Well, that's certainly the argument that I'm trying to construct in the book. And I like to think that I've gone quite a long way with suggesting that the relationships are very similar. In particular, most of the concepts of social structure that I'm developing are based on the idea that there are groups of people, and those groups of people are a thing, an entity, a social group which has emergent properties, and has those emergent properties as a result of being composed of those people and a certain set of relations between them. So that, in a sense, is similar to the torch version of the concept, but there is at least one sense in which it's different, and that is that the kinds of relationships that exist between the parts of simple physical objects are very clearly sort of spatial relationships, whereas the kinds of relationships that exist between the people who make up a social group are, they may be incidentally spatial, but they're primarily not. You know, the members of an organization continue to be members of it, and the organization continues to have whatever powers it does, irrespective of where those people are. They don't have to be in some kind of physical contact with each other. And instead of spatial relationships, it's what we might call intentional relationships, you know, relationships based on the mental properties of the members of the group that make that group something more than just the sum of the parts.
And does this bring an added level of difficulty to social science explanation?
Absolutely. I think at a couple of levels. I think, you know, first at the level that it's quite difficult for us as human beings to think of ourselves as cogs in a larger machine that may be causally significant and impacting on what we do, particularly when those objects aren't kind of empirically obvious to us. But I think the other reason that it's difficult is that one consequence of the fact that these social structures depend on intentional relationships rather than spatial ones is that it's possible for people to be parts of many different social structures at the same time. You know, the battery can only be part of one torch at any one time, but the person can be part of many different social structures, organizations, structures I call norm circles, and no doubt many other sorts of social structure too. And it's that kind of detachment of structure from spatiality that makes that possible. But it also makes it much more difficult to disentangle the effects of these various structures on any particular individual and any particular event.
I read you as saying that this is why questions of social ontology are crucial for social science, because of this entanglement in so many different phenomena.
Absolutely, and I think ontology is crucial to any science, but that's almost taken for granted in the natural sciences. You know, people assume that if you're going to say that a certain kind of thing can have certain sorts of effects, then you're going to be interested in the nature of that thing and how it comes to have those powers, whereas in the social sciences, I think that these difficulties have perhaps encouraged people to back away from the possibility of causal explanations.
And can you say a little bit about your account of causation? I mean, how does it differ from other prevailing views within the social sciences?
Well, the view of causation is that I take is very much based on Bhaskar's. And for Bhaskar, causation is best explained by thinking of two different aspects. On the one hand, we have what he calls real causal powers. So things have powers. And causal powers are essentially the same thing as emergent properties in this story. So individual things have causal powers that derive from the structure of the thing, the way that the parts that make it up combine and interact to provide those things with particular powers. So that's one part of the story. And the other part of the story is that when we want to explain any particular event in the world, then we need to recognize that events are almost inevitably caused not by some single causal precursor, but by a combination of multiple causal powers interacting to produce the event. Now, that's quite a radically different version of causality than the one that's often kind of taken as read when the word cause is used, which is the kind of the old positivist version associated with people like David Hume and Karl Hempel. Hempel with his kind of deductive nomological model of cause, in which cause is simply the fact that an event of type A is always followed by an event of type B. Now, with the realist model of cause that I'm working with, we don't get those kinds of exceptionless regularities. You know, because any particular kind of event B is always the outcome of multiple other events interacting, or multiple other causal powers, I should say, interacting to produce it, it may be that sometimes causal power A might be present in causal, and consequence B may not occur. So causal powers in this kind of model are always tendencies. There is a tendency for A to produce B, but that tendency generally will depend on the presence of other factors and could be frustrated and prevented in particular cases.
And in terms of causal explanation, you distinguish what you call eliminative reduction from explanatory reduction. Could you say a little bit about this distinction?
Indeed. So this issue of reductionism is one that's quite central to the philosophy of science, and it intrudes into the social sciences in the guise of methodological individualism. So methodological individualism, to put it simply, is the idea that social structures aren't really causally effective, and don't really exist, because whatever is attributed to social structures is really just caused by individual people. So that's a kind of reductionism. It's saying, well, you know, there may be things that we might call social structures made up of people, but they don't really have any significance. It's the people who have the significance. You know, the causal influence of the structure has been reduced to that of the people. Now, the general model that I'm working with is one in which we can't explain away causal powers. So if we can explain, we can show that there is a causal power of a social group that arises from the way that the members of that group interact with each other, then having explained the causal power of the group in terms of the contributions of the individuals is an explanatory reduction, if you like, but it's not an eliminative reduction because it doesn't explain away the causal significance of the group. What it means is that, you know, as in the case of the torch, you know, we're saying that all of those parts have to be present in those relations that are characteristic of that particular kind of whole, you know, in this case, an organization for the sake of argument, for the causal effects that we observe to occur, the causal powers that we can find evidence for to be present. So what we're saying is that we can't eliminate the organization, the social goal, or whatever, from our explanation just because we can explain the ways in which its powers are produced.
So as we discussed earlier, you have to trace out this relationship between the parts, their configuration, and the whole.
Absolutely, absolutely. You need to, you know, what I'm trying to do is to, and to encourage other people to do, I guess, is to look for the mechanisms through which the parts of a social whole interact to produce the powers of that whole.
One of the most theoretically ambitious sections of your book is your method for social ontology. Could you say a little bit about this and how it's to be applied?
Well, yes. I mean, in a sense, I've given you much of the content of that already, in the sense that what I'm looking at here is applying the kind of thinking about ontology that I've outlined in mostly quite abstract terms so far to the social world. So that means looking for the entities, the causal powers that they have, and examining how it is that the parts of those entities and the relations between them interact to give us the mechanisms that produce the powers. So it's taking that ontology and applying it to the social world, which is what the whole book is trying to do. And having said that, I suppose the other thing that I should say about it is that that allows us to be methodologically, quite pluralist, that there are many lots of different methods that we can use in the kind of application of these principles. And one of the things that I'm encouraging is the idea that there's a kind of two-way relationship between this sort of very abstract ontology of causation and emergence, the more specifically social ontology of the kinds of things, social groups, etc., that are influential in the social world, and the more detailed theory and empirical work that's kind of more typical in the social sciences, that each of these has to be, in a sense, consistent with each other. And that doesn't mean that there's one direction in which these relationships run. It's not, and I'm certainly not saying that philosophical ontology comes first and then everything else must fit in with that. I think there's a two-way relationship.
I really like the idea of iteration that you use to describe this relationship, so this continual process of one end feeding into the other.
Yes, indeed. I mean, one of the things that that I encourage is the idea that we can kind of hypothesize one part of this kind of complex interrelated structure, but then we need to investigate whether it fits with the rest of it. So, if we hypothesize that there's a particular kind of thing with particular kinds of powers, then we need to investigate the mechanisms, see how that fits with the theory of that particular phenomenon, see how that relates to the empirical evidence, and be prepared to change our theory, our ontology in response to those things. And even ultimately be prepared to change our philosophical ontology if the substance of those other investigations suggests that there's something wrong or something missing in the philosophical ontology. So there should be influences running in all different directions between the parts of this scheme, and we can't ever solve the whole problem in one go. We have to do our best to solve one part of the problem and then see what implications that has for the rest of the picture and be prepared to revise other parts of the picture and go around in that circle as long as it takes to get to a reasonable theory of whatever it is we're trying to investigate.
So it's ultimately a practical process as opposed to seeking theoretical closure and a final correct picture.
Yes, I mean, there will never be a final, correct and complete picture of the social world. I mean, that's unthinkable. We can hypothesize answers for a piece at a time and try to get some useful value out of that, but always we need to be open to the possibility that we'll need to change.
Because this seems predicated on a very clear understanding of the role of social theory in relation to other aspects of the research process, which, speaking as someone who's been through lots of theory and methods courses at university, I think is largely lacking from the way social theory is taught, sense of how it fits into other endeavours.
Yes. I mean, that's certainly lacking. I think that's very true. And I think people in all theoretical traditions have struggled to find very close, tight connections between the empirical approaches and some of the more abstract theory in the social world. And in a way, part of the solution that I'm offering is that there aren't those tight connections. It's not the case that having a realist ontology, for example, mandates certain empirical methods. So there's quite a loose connection, and yet there has to be a certain kind of relationship between the findings.
Moving on a little bit to your concepts of social structure, could you talk about how it differs from other such accounts that listeners might be familiar with?
Okay, well, if you don't mind, I'll talk about a fairly abstract account. No, abstract's perhaps not the right word. A sort of anonymous account, shall we say. I mean, the The tradition, I think, in sociology that's more common than any other is to assume that social structures are there and we can say that they explain things without looking inside the books. Latour, one thing Latour I like in Latour's work is that he says that that sociology has treated social structures as black boxes, you know, where we can attribute causal significance to them, but we don't have to open the black box to find out where that significance comes from. And absolutely agree with them on that front, although Latour's option seems to be to discard structure altogether. My response is not to discard social structure, but to open the black box. You know, let's look inside the box and establish what the mechanisms are that produce the effects that we attribute to structure, rather than just treating it as something that can be effective that we don't have to think about further.
And in terms of your account of agency, you outline what you call an emergentist theory of action, which intends to integrate the work of Margaret Archer on reflexivity and Bourdieu's work on habitus. Could you say a little bit about the basis for the synthesis and some of the theoretical issues it engages with?
Yes, I can do that. At one level, the basis for this is just the same argument that I'm making about social structure, that people are entities with causal capabilities that arise from their parts and the way that their parts are put together. So at any one time, you know, the tendencies that each of us has to act in certain ways, for example, are a product of our physical structures, including the structures of our brains and the mental properties, the kind of emergent properties of that. But we have to complement that, which sounds superficially a very kind of biologically reductionist point of view, although not biologically oriented, perhaps I should say. I'm trying to resist the idea that it's reductionist. We have to complement that with an understanding of how it is that we have come to have the structures that we do. And in particular, this is not the only thing that matters, but in particular, the ways in which we come to have the kind of brain structures that we do, and hence the mental properties, the beliefs, the desires, the dispositions. And those things can be influenced by our social experience. So we can say that at any one time, you know, our powers, our tendencies, our capabilities are a function of the physical person we are right now, while still retaining a sociological perspective by looking into how it is that our social experience shapes the person that we are. And I think Bourdieu and Archer are stressing two different processes that shape the person that we are. You know, Bourdieu is stressing the kind of subconscious absorption of influence from our environment, which certainly, you know, can influence our brains and our beliefs, our dispositions. And Archer is stressing the ways in which we sometimes reflect upon, you know, the people that we are, you know, the commitments that we have in life, the situation that we face, and therefore the, you know, the projects that we're going to pursue. And both of those, it seems to me, are perfectly valid processes through which, you know, the person that we are is influenced. And so I think with that kind of perspective, we can not exactly reconcile Archer and Bourdieu. I know that Archer doesn't want to be reconciled to Bourdieu, but we can take material from both their arguments and put it together into a theory of agency that allows and recognizes the significance of both of those kinds of processes and influencing the ways in which people act.
And would you take the balance between the two, the balance between habitual dispositions and reflexive deliberation in any individual to be a product of wider forces?
Yes, absolutely. And it's clear, and this is something that I know that Margaret Archer has been working on herself, it's clear that the balance of those forces has been changing over time. That, you know, one of the features of modernity and you know, high modernity, late modernity, whatever you think we're in now, in particular, is that reflexivity is becoming increasingly significant. People have more opportunity and in a sense, more pressure to be reflexive about themselves and their lives, their commitments, than they could or were expected to in earlier social systems.
Perhaps the most distinctive contribution your book makes to social theory is your account of normativity. What sort of problems do you see in existing debates about norms and normativity?
Well, existing accounts of normativity, I think, tend to fall into two groups. There are those that think of normativity in individual terms and those that think of it in collective terms. And both of them you can trace back to Durkheim to some extent. On the one hand, we have the idea of individual representations that each one of us has our own set of beliefs or dispositions that are normatively shaped. And that's what causes us to behave in normatively standardized ways. And on the other hand, we have the kind of idea of collective representations, that there's some sort of collective element to those beliefs that makes us all behave in similar ways. And neither of those seems to me entirely satisfactory. I mean, the idea that we have just individual representations seems to lack any kind of explanation of why it is that actually our behaviours would be standardised. We could all have completely different views as to what's appropriate behaviour, and if it was just a matter of individual representations. But the problem, the alternative of normativity being embedded in collective representations also seems to be very unsatisfactory, because it's hard to see just where those collective representations could exist, what sorts of things they could be. If they're something different than individual beliefs and dispositions. And so I want to retain the collective element, but not to deliver it through collective representations. And the collective, for me, is a social group. And in particular, looking at this issue, I've developed the idea of a social group called a norm circle. So a norm circle is that group of people that is committed to endorsing and enforcing a particular norm. And the idea is that each of us is exposed to the influence of norm circles, and as a result of that, we are more likely to observe, to conform with the norms that those norm circles that influence us advocate. So norm circles then are entities composed of people related to each other through this shared commitment to endorse and enforce the norm concerned, which have a causal power as a result of that mechanism. And the causal power is to influence those people around it, and those people are parts of it, to tend to conform to the norm.
Could you talk a little bit about an example, just to flesh out the concept?
An example to flesh out the concept. There are so many examples. It's difficult to know where to start. I mean, just the idea, for example, that we should drive on the left-hand side of the road. In the UK, where we're recording this, it's the custom, the law, that people should drive on the left-hand side of the road. And that's, in theory, I suppose, enforced legally, but in practice it's not enforced legally, so it's enforced by the reactions of other drivers. You try to drive down the wrong side of the street, then you'll very quickly find that there are people slamming the brakes on, flashing lights, shouting at you. So there's a large group of people that's committed to the norm that you should drive on the left-hand side of the street in the UK, and that exert pressure on that. It's interesting to contrast that with another driving case, which is there's a law in the UK that on a motorway you shouldn't drive faster than 70 miles an hour. And do you know what's people drive faster than 70 miles an hour all the time on the motorways in the UK, because there isn't that same normal circle enforcing that. Okay, I know that the drive on the left-hand side of the road is perhaps not an ideal example, because actually we would all bang into each other and have horrible accidents if we didn't do that. But you know, there's an argument made that driving fast contributes to accidents too, and yet people still do it. And because there isn't that norm circle, you know, the constant stream of people flashing their lights at you and shouting at you and so on, when you breach that standard, there isn't really a norm.
So there's an important distinction between legislation and its enforcement on the one hand,
yes,
and the actual felt need to conform to a norm.
Absolutely.
On the other.
Absolutely.
And you talk a lot about normative intersectionality. What do you mean by this? Why is it important?
Well, one of the nice features, I think, of the norm circles model is that there's a different norm circle for every norm. So, you know, as we've just seen, no doubt there are people who enforce and endorse the 70 mile an hour limits on motorways. And perhaps some of those people, I guess probably most of those people, are also part of the norm circle for driving on the left-hand side of the road. But there are, so there are kind of two overlapping groups, if you like, but different groups that endorse and enforce these two different norms. And I think that's absolutely typical of the way that normativity works. You know, there are some norms that are advocated by some groups, other norms that are advocated by other groups, and there are many norms that overlap many other norm circles. And that's very much in contrast to the idea that normativity is produced by some sort of monolithic society, that there is society is a social structure which enforces normativity on all of us. Because if that was the case, it would be quite hard to explain why it is, that there's such diversity, that, you know, that within what we might call the same society, there are groups who pursue quite different social practices, and sometimes, you know, quite contradictory social practices. So we need to find some kind of middle level structure that's responsible for normativity to get over that. And I think norm circles does that very nicely. And I think that that's particularly important in contemporary society again, because the sheer diversity of normative environments in contemporary society is staggering and constantly increasing. I mean, not only is there the thing that Durkheim identified with different sorts of specializations developing different normative standards, there's multiculturalism, there's the development of all sorts of subcultures, and none of that makes sense unless we can say that normativity is something that's enforced by quite diverse groups, and the norm circles theory, I think, gives us a way of understanding that.
And does that normative heterogeneity create problems which agents must navigate?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think we're all exposed at times to conflicting normative pressures, and that is something which is a major source of normative change in society. When the whole of a society, a word I don't really like, but the whole of a social space is kind of suffused by much the same norms, there's very little opportunity for people to think differently. But once people are faced with conflicting and alternative norms for related practices, then there's much more opportunity for reflexivity. There's much more opportunity for people to start thinking about which of those practices they would adopt and why. So it's tied up, I think, with the increase in reflexivity that we mentioned earlier.
And just to bring the podcast to a close, what do you think of the pressing issues which social theory must confront?
That's a big question. I think that one of the biggest issues is that social theory needs to get over this kind of dualism that has been embedded in the social sciences for quite a long time, that the idea that the social world is utterly different than the natural world, that operates in a very different way. And so, for example, notions of causality that apply to the natural world don't apply to the social. And there again, I guess there's an echo of some of the things that Latour has been saying. But again, unlike Latour, I wanted to solve that by continuing with the notion of causality and seeing the ways in which we can apply similar but you know, adjusted as necessary causal models from the natural world to the social world. I think that I've tried to do that in this book on the traditional questions of structure and agency, but I think we need to apply that much more widely. And certainly I've been trying in work that I've done since this to apply that to issues like language, discourse, culture, and I'm planning in future work to try and apply it to the structures of our economic and political systems too.
That sounds fascinating. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Mark.